not much of a Martha Stewart living kind of person. Why is that so funny? I get a laugh right away on that one. I'm not much of a Martha Stewart kind of person. I subscribed to a magazine at one point that was like called Simple Living or something. And I thought, oh, well, you know, that's good. And I didn't realize that it was affiliated with Martha Stewart Living or whatever. And so then I started getting emails and, you know, other magazine offers for Martha Stewart Magazine and things like that. And I'm not really in her circle that she's trying to reach. You know, there are all these suggestions for, like, when you pack your child's lunch for school, you should enclose a handmade card with a stamp that you carved out of a potato that morning. And I thought, I'm doing pretty well if I remembered the sandwich. So, you know, there's kind of a little bit of a gap between what I think is really important and necessary and what Martha Stewart thinks is important and necessary. And if I have a napkin at my table, or if you come to my house to eat and I give you a napkin on which to wipe your fingers, that's pretty good. You know, I mean, it would be far too much to ask that it be folded into some sort of origami crane. It's just not important. It is not on my list of priorities. But she's got a lot of suggestions about decoration and also about etiquette and how we are to behave and what we should do and all this stuff. I do think that Jesus wins etiquette points with Martha Stewart for his first suggestion. I think that she would go along with this. What he basically says to, you know, he's observing all these people kind of jockeying for the best seats in the house when they come to this dinner that he's been invited to. You know, kind of like when people come to church and they all jockey for the best seats in the house, which are way in the back. And, you know, so he sees people kind of all jockeying for position here, and he says, well, you know, just kind of practically here. It's better to take a less honorable seat, because then somebody might come to you and say, oh, you're here! Come on forward! I didn't know you were... No, you don't need to sit way back there. Or again in church, you don't need to sit way up there, it's okay. Come on back to the good seats, you know. You are a person of honor, you are a guest of honor, we want you up front, and everybody gets to see as that person comes forward. Otherwise, you know, if you've sat in the seat that was really reserved for the guest speaker or for the host of honor, or the guest of honor, the host might say, excuse me, I need you to move because that seat is reserved and you can take the one that's left over there. This actually happened at our wedding, as I'm thinking about the wedding anniversary thing, where somebody had brought an extra person that wasn't on the head count. And so my mom's table got filled. You know, we had like three head tables because we had my in-laws and my father and my mother all had their own kind of head family table. And at my mom's table, there were 11 people and 10 chairs. And the hotel staff are trying to tell one of my mom's best friends that she has to move, you know, from her seat of honor because we had an extra person. We ended up bringing in an extra chair. But it's very embarrassing. It's just as embarrassing for the host, really, as it is for the people at the table. But, you know, it's just kind of awkward how to avoid these social faux pas. Martha Stewart cares about these things. And apparently so does Jesus. Now, I must say this happens to me quite often, actually. Almost every time I go to the State House to do the opening devotion, the Senate doesn't care. They're, like, really low-key, and there are 30 senators, and they're never all there at once, at least not for devotions. And so I can kind of... we'll wonder about that one, too, but... So I can kind of wander in and sit. There's like one little couch next to the podium, and I'll sit there, and then when it's time, which is usually like 20 minutes after it's supposed to be, they'll call me up, and I'll do my devotion, and I'll leave. But for some reason in the House of Representatives, I'm never in the right seat. So they always say, go in and sit in the chair next to the podium. When you get in there, there's a chair on either side of the podium. There's a whole line of chairs, but there's a chair on either side of the podium. And it doesn't seem to matter which one I sit in, it's always the wrong one. So I'll go in and I'll sit on the one on the right and they'll ask me to move to the one on the left, or they'll sit on the one on the left and ask me, you know, I'll be sitting there for like 5 or 10 minutes waiting, and then somebody in a dark hunter green Vermont suit coat will come up and say, oh, Reverend, we're so glad that you're here to do the devotions today. Thank you so much. Can I just ask you to either move to the other side or move down one, because this seat is reserved for so-and-so, and I have to get up, and I have to move to the other chair, and, you know, it's a little bit embarrassing. I need to take a page from the Gospel of Luke, or the Book of Martha Stewart, and you know, remind myself that Jesus says I should just sit as far away from the podium as possible, and then when it's time, they'll be like, Reverend Clark, why are you so far away? Please come forward and sit in a seat of honor and give us a devotional. But I never do that. Anyway, it's an almost humorous, practical thing that Jesus is telling the people at this dinner to do. And in the midst of this sort of kind of practical advice, he's also telling them, giving them a little bit of a lesson about humility. Basically saying in a pretty blunt way, don't go thinking that you're all that, that you're the most important person at the party, that you're the guest of honor, that you're the most exciting thing to walk into the room. Chill out, relax a little bit, don't think so highly of yourself. Let other people tell you if they want you to move up a bit, but maybe, you know, take a back row for a little bit, play second fiddle for a little bit, and let somebody else invite you to a position of honor and prestige. Of course, the irony in this is that Jesus is, in a sense, the guest of honor here. I mean, now he turns to his host and he says, now, when you give a banquet, don't go inviting important people and rich people and your friends and neighbors and the ones you know are going to invite you to a better party, but invite poor people, people who are disabled, people who are hungry, people who are broken, people who are outcast. They can't invite you to any other parties. Now, Martha Stewart does not approve of this, right? I mean, there's almost like a whole giving guide kind of thing, like what kind of gift you should give in proportion to the one you've received from somebody else. You don't want it to be too much more expensive or less expensive than the one you've received, or vice versa. If you haven't yet received a gift, but like, you know, you're going to a wedding shower and then they're coming to yours, you know, how do you, so that you can kind of figure out what they're going to give you and how to best maneuver all of these things. You know, inviting poor people to your party, what is this about? You know? And here is Jesus saying this to the Pharisee who's invited him to his own house. Now, I see a couple of options for why the Pharisee has invited Jesus, and I think that we can be pretty sure which one it is. One possibility is that the Pharisee has invited Jesus because Jesus is poor, because Jesus represents poor people, and the Pharisee wants to reach out to the poor people. Of course, Jesus wouldn't rebuke him if that were the case, so we can kind of assume that that's not why the Pharisee invited Jesus. It could be that the Pharisee invited Jesus because he, on some spiritual level, recognized that Jesus was important, and he wanted to invite Jesus to the banquet and to his meal from a kind of spiritual sense. He wanted to be in the presence of Christ. But we don't really get that sense from this Pharisee or from Jesus' response to him, that he's saying, oh, you know, at least you scored well on one. You did actually invite the most important person to your dinner. You invited the living God. Good job. No, he says, don't invite people to build your own prestige, to puff up your own honor, or people that you think are going to repay you. So it seems to me that this Pharisee invited Jesus because he thought he was going to get something out of it. Now, clearly he wasn't invited to Jesus' own banquet, a few weeks later. Only 12 people showed up at that one, and the Pharisee doesn't seem to have been on the list. So he didn't get a return invitation out of it. It seems that the Pharisee invited Jesus because he was interesting. You know, he was that new guy in town who was making a lot of noise and getting a lot of press attention, and everybody wanted to know, like, what's this guy really about? Whose side is he on? You know, whose politics does he back? Is he with the Pharisees or the Sadducees or the Zealots or the Essenes or those weird people out in the desert? Who's he with? He can't support the Romans, so who does he support? Like, what's his agenda? What's his politics? And how do we get in with him? Because he seems to be popular with the people. So maybe we can get popular with him and then we'll be popular with the people too. It seems that the Pharisee has invited Jesus because he wants to look better. He wants to look important. He might not get a great invitation out of Jesus. I mean, the guy's a wandering, itinerant minister carpenter, after all. What kind of banquet's he going to throw? But he wants to get some prestige out of the fact that he's invited the new guy in town, the most intriguing, if you will, freak show that there is in town right now, this strange, miracle-performing rabbi. So he's going to get something out of the fact that he's invited Jesus. And Jesus says, that's not what it's about. Can you imagine if there was a book on etiquette that told you that when you throw a fundraising gala, you know, a political fundraising banquet, $1,000 a plate and people in evening dresses and tuxedos and everybody schmoozing and rubbing elbows, that you should try not to invite all the political head honchos and the people with lots of money who are going to pad your election coffers, but you should invite the poor people because, you know, you've got all this food and they don't, and so here's a whole bunch of hungry people, and that's who you should invite. That book of etiquette would get tossed right out the window. Martha Stewart does not approve. Can you imagine if somebody said, when you have a wedding, it's great that you invite your family and your friends, and they're going to give you presents, lots of presents. But you should also invite the people from your community that you don't know very well, that you don't like, that you don't want to spend time with or hang out with, because you're having a meal and you're celebrating, and they should be included in that too. You should, you know, put them in the head count and serve them the dinner that you're working so hard to pay for the few people you have invited. Well, that wedding planning book gets tossed out the window because it doesn't fit with the way we put together things today. Jesus has never fit with the way we put these things together. Because it's the same story. It's that it's not about our pride. It's not about whether we're the most important people in the room or what we're going to get out of it. It's about what we do with what we've been given, and it's about what the right thing is. Now, on the other hand, Jesus is going to take the metaphor of the banquet in the next few verses in this passage from Luke, and he's going to extend it into a metaphor about the kingdom of God. But we can be a lot more literal about it, because we do have banquets and feasts and dinners and community lunches and communion and worship service and a whole bunch of other things. And so we can ask ourselves, who do we invite to these banquets, to these celebrations? And these are one of these instances where, not that we want to boast and pat ourselves on the back all the time, but we can celebrate the things we do really well. And we can be proud of the ways, not proud like we should get seats of honor, but proud like we have responded well in many places. And we give thanks for that. Because quite often, at least once a week, we do have a banquet here. And we do invite people who are hungry to just come and eat. And we don't expect anything. Not a thing. There's a donation jar if people want to give a donation, but nobody's watching it. And it would keep going if there was nothing placed in it. Because it's supported by the congregation, and we feed the people who are hungry. And we have a food pantry downstairs in our church. There are places where that would be a deterrent, where people would say, no, we don't want that in our church. Because you're going to attract, by definition, poor people. Or to the thrift store. You're going to attract people who, you know, need clothes. Not just sales shoppers, but people who need stuff and who are, by definition, less fortunate. You're going to get some undesirable characters around here. And I got to say, I've heard a ton of reasons, good, bad, indifferent, to do or to not do something, but never once in 2 years have I heard somebody say about any proposal in this church, no, we can't do that because that's going to attract undesirable people. That's going to attract poor people. That's going to attract drug addicts. That's going to attract alcoholics seeking recovery. That's, you know, seeking recovery. We have all of these programs at our church that do attract people who are less desirable, perhaps, in the eyes of others. And we keep doing it. I was approached by a member of one of the 12-step groups that meets in our church over the weekend, thanking us. Because in the midst of everything we did yesterday, we made sure that that 12-step meeting still happened, still had a private place to meet. And the 4th of July weekend is a tough time for people in recovery from substance abuse because so many people celebrate with substances. And there's, you know, there's beer and liquor everywhere on the 4th of July weekend, coolers of it, just kind of pouring out of people's trucks and stuff. And the person came up to me and said, thank you for making sure that in the midst of all of what you were doing as a church community, that you made sure we had a place to be that was safe for us, that was alcohol and drug free, and that could still be a priority in the midst of everything else you were doing. And there are places and there are situations in which we might not think first about inviting the broken or those in need into a community. And this church does that so beautifully and so well. That's not to say we stop and we pat ourselves on the back, rest on our laurels and give up and say, well, we've done everything we can do. We have to keep asking ourselves that question, that intention. How do we continue to extend that invitation? How do we make it really clear to folks that come on into worship, we expect nothing from you? If you never have a thing to put in the offering plate, that's okay. You're hungry too. Come on in. If you don't have the ability to give back in some way right now or ever, that's not what it's about. How do we keep making that invitation more and more explicit to people? We'll meet you where you are with what you need. Because it's not about us and our position at the table, and it's not about us and what we might get in return for inviting somebody prestigious into our community. It's about what we have and what we're called to share, and how we share it more and more. There's another banquet that we're all invited to. We remember that 12-person banquet seemed kind of small and insignificant. Even then, sometimes the folks invited to it tended to argue ahead of the banquet about who got to sit where. And even then, there were some people who didn't like their seats or left their seats or didn't feel that they could stay at the banquet. But we remember that 12-person banquet, and that the people who were at it were not perfect and were not men and women of honor, but were broken, poor folks. And then we celebrate that banquet again and again and again as the banquet of the Lord's table. And we recognize that there are no good seats in the house when it comes to that banquet, not even in the back of the church, not even in the front of the church, not even the seats where you can take communion and then leave really quickly, not even the seats where you can choose not to and remain relatively anonymous. There are no good seats. There are no bad seats. But each person who comes to this banquet is invited to come forward to meet the host, not the pastor or the person presiding at the table, but Christ, the presence of Christ. Each person is invited to come forward for a time of encounter with God. And we remember that at this banquet, we're not invited because we're the guests of honor, or because we have something wonderful to offer back that God needs from us. We are encouraged and empowered and inspired, we hope, and led to respond in service to God's gifts. But that's not why we're invited. We're invited because we are the poor. We are the hungry. We are the broken, the maimed, the undesirable. We're invited to this banquet because we need to eat. We need to eat of the bread of life. We need to share in the grace of God. And so we pray that we might come to this table with humble hearts, with thankful hearts, not because we folded our napkins correctly, not because our names are on the place cards and we're sitting in the right seat, but because we're the broken ones that God has invited. We are the undesirable ones that God still desires. And because we've been invited to God's table, despite all that, may we be more willing to invite others to our tables. Amen.